Thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here. So as we all know, there is a lot of dark matter in the universe, and we have many independent gravitational lines of evidence for the existence of some form of matter that walks and talks like a new, massive particle. We know to a high degree of precision from evidence from individual galaxies, galaxy clusters, all the way up to the clustering of matter on the very biggest observational scales, that we know to a remarkable degree of accuracy how much of it there is, that it behaves like a massive particle, and not only does it not talk to us very strongly, it doesn't talk to itself arbitrarily strongly, and that's about as much as we know. And we have learned this all from gravitational interactions indirectly. We don't really have any reason to believe that dark matter should interact with us any way other than gravitationally until you specify some ideas for how did dark matter get in the universe to start with. And so the best expectation we have that dark matter should be something that we can interact with at any appreciable rate is the WIMP miracle, so thermal WIMPs. If you have a species that is in thermal equilibrium with the standard model in the hot plasma of the early universe, then as the universe expands and cools, the processes that keep the dark matter in equilibrium with the standard model can become slower than the expansion of the universe, at which point, however much dark matter you've got, you're stuck with. And so just comparing the scattering rate to the expansion of the universe picks out for you an interaction rate. And then you can go and say, if this is how my dark matter gets into the universe, there are many different ways in which I can test the consequences of this hypothesis. The residual interactions in dense places like the galaxy halos can give you cosmic ray signatures. Crossing symmetry tells you that you have elastic scattering of the ambient dark matter off of us. Cross it again, and you can make dark matter directly in pairs. And this is the essence of what has been a very successful dark matter search program. And when I say very successful, I mean mostly successful in ruling out possibilities that are very well motivated. So the very first generation of dark matter direct detection experiments basically ruled out particles that have unsuppressed couplings to the Z boson. Now we're at the point where we're ruling out particles where you have one dark matter particle, its relic abundance is set by Higgs scattering. Those are the standard model mediators we know about. And we're very successful at killing this parameter space. Of course, as people in this room know very well, freeze out via mediators that are not standard model states, but other states, can require new search strategies, some of which can be very hard. If you have very light dark matter, most of the search strategies of the mainstream program fail, and you need new ideas to cover the relic density region. And if you have, say, pseudoscalar mediators, those are particularly difficult in terms of giving you observable signals at colliders or at direct detection experiments, even for relatively heavy dark matter that gives you good, in principle, sensitivity. And in fact, some of the best constraints actually come from non-dark matter related signals, such as mixing and coupling to the Higgs boson. But there are many possibilities besides thermal WIMPs. And as soon as you go away from this thermal WIMP picture, things get very complicated and they go off in many different directions. Dark matter doesn't have to be thermal. Dark matter's relic density doesn't have to necessarily have anything to do with its interactions with the standard model. And as soon as you go away from this thermal WIMP picture, you no longer have any reason to expect that the non-gravitational interactions of dark matter with us should happen at terrestrially relevant rates. Nothing guarantees that anymore. The nice lower bound that you had on the couplings of dark matter to the standard model was a consequence of your initial hypothesis for how dark matter got in the universe in the first place. Go away from that, there's no more guarantee. So a nice example is provided by hidden sector freeze-out. It's a nice, simple, very predictive framework, and it's also very quickly brings you to nightmare scenarios. So the WIMP miracle more generally is a statement about perturbative thermal relics. There is some range of masses and cross-sections for which dark matter as a perturbative thermal relic gives you the right relic abundance. If you go if you go to too strong, if you go up to too heavy masses, they have to interact very strongly in order to deplete the relic abundance sufficiently much, keep cranking up that mass, and eventually your cross-section becomes, you know, perturbative, you know, non-perturbative, it becomes strongly coupled, and you have to do a different kind of calculation. If you specify what kind of theory you're talking about and talk a bit more detail about unitarity, you can bring down this lower bound, but if you just put some sort of perturbativity back of the envelope calculation, you get order, you know, tens of TeV for sort of a rough upper bound. On the lower bound, you have trouble getting enough dark matter particles packed into the observed phase space density of dwarf galaxies. This bound is very easy to see where it comes from for fermions, which obviously, you know, have polyblocking. But you can make a similar, although statistical, statement about bosonic dark matter as well. So this bound is a bit looser. It comes out in order KeV scale. So this is a very broad mass range, but it's bounded. And it's a mass range that is, you know, roughly coincident with the standard model mass range, which means we don't need super futuristic technologies to study things that live in this mass range. We can do that already. Of course, the Wimp miracle says that standard model weak interactions are part of this, you know, mass range, and in retrospect, that's really not that surprising. Okay. So the problem with hidden sector dark matter and hidden sector freeze-out is that the nice relationship between the dark matter abundance and the standard model dark matter interaction is broken. Thermal history of dark matter fixes the coupling of, say, dark matter to the states it freezes out to, but if those states are in the dark sector and not directly in the standard model, that doesn't help. The hidden sector coupling to the standard model does not have to be very large before this hidden sector state can just decay in the early universe promptly enough to leave no imprint on our earliest experimental data, which is Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So from a terrestrial point of view, this coupling can be small enough to be completely unimportant for our foreseeable future. So because mediator couplings to the standard model can be parametrically small, you do a nice way to classify the ways in which the dark sector can talk to the standard model in a, you know, gauge invariant way. There's a limited set of these things, and you can classify these in terms of the low-lying dimensional operators that you can that are total singlets that you can construct out of standard model fields. So at a renormalizable level, you can write down scalar interactions with the Higgs boson, vector interactions with the hypercharged field strength, go up to dimension 5, and there's another very interesting operator where you can couple pseudoscalars to products of gauge boson field strengths. If you don't have a two Higgs doublet model, this is a leading way you can couple a pseudoscalar to the standard model. So it's these are some of the most important ones. And the nice thing about hidden sector freeze-out is that, yeah?
You cannot have a fermion for them?
Oh, you can. Uh-huh. That gives you...
better than the neutrino.
Yeah, yeah. So neutrino portal is also definitely interesting. Part of the reason I'm not talking about it now is because you have to make some additional flavor choices. But on the other hand, it is lepton number violating, so that gives you some additional, you know, fun to play with if you want to play with, in particular, asymmetric dark matter. Yeah. Okay. So the nice thing about hidden sector freeze-out is indirect detection signals are much harder to dial away. All your terrestrial signals are dependent on a parameter that has nothing to do with the cosmic origin of your dark matter. But your indirect detection signals are just fundamental. You can't play games to get rid of them the same way you can play games to get around terrestrial constraints. So the way you see dark matter you know, in the wild, if you will, all these searches are probing this particular combination of astronomical and particle physics information. So what you see is the total annihilation rate, so cross-section times number density, times whatever channel you're looking at, integrate along the line of sight of your dark matter density. So you look at a whole bunch of different targets, and that just changes the astrophysics here. But you're always measuring exactly the same combination of particle physics information over here. So one of the interesting and important questions is, can we get more information about particle physics models beyond this simple set of combination of parameters that you can test in the HALO direct detection or indirect detection signal? Okay. So one way to approach that is to look at the evolution of astrophysical objects. You have some model for the formation history of some astrophysical objects, such as a neutron star. You ask what happens if it interacts with dark matter in various different ways. But something I'm going to talk about today is that you can actually get qualitatively novel cosmic ray signals if you just take your same indirect detection experiments and you look specifically at the cosmic ray signals from supermassive black holes. And I will show you that dark matter density spikes let you probe some different information about dark matter than you get just from black hole from galaxy halos. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about what these black hole-induced density spikes are. So I'm going to start out by showing you the simplest kind of dark matter density spike. This is the kind of spike that you get when you take some dark matter halo, and you have a supermassive black hole in the center of that halo, and it grows adiabatically. So it sort of slowly accretes mostly gas and dust and slowly gets bigger. So start off with, say, for definiteness, an NFW halo. This has the important property that it's cuspy. So in the inner halo, it is going like R to a power. So it's strictly speaking, the phase space density is singular at the origin. Okay. So we'll start growing from that halo. So for NFW, gamma C would be 1. But for a generalized NFW, this parameter in general can be bigger than 1. Then the spike keeps growing up until it gets to the black hole zone of influence. This is the radius at which the black hole, or you know, again, any point mass would work, but to get interesting signals, you have to have something that's supermassive black hole size. This is the radius at which the kinetic energy of the dark matter in the halo is dominated by the gravitational potential energy. So basically, inside this radius, the black hole is the most important thing dynamically in the region. Some distance inside this.
Would be zero for you?
I have put in a specific value of V0, which is 105 kilometers per second, which is actually taken somewhat roughly from observation, but we'll talk in more detail about the uncertainties in these quantities.
The distribution of the velocity. Are you making any assumptions so far?
So I assumed a value, and I assumed it was isotropic. And constant is a function of radius roughly outside this region. So some distance inside this zone of influence, the spike itself actually starts growing. And so the spike doesn't actually start growing until about a fifth of the gravitational zone of influence. I don't know how to argue for that, except this is what happens when people simulate this numerically. So that's where that factor of 1/5 comes from. So inside this outer radius of the spike, there's a very steep power law, which is related to the original halo power law by the following expression. So it's always at least 2, but then there's a small bit that depends on this, how steep the halo was that you grew from. And you can get this actually very simply just by assuming adiabatic growth. You have, by assumption, that phase-based density is conserved and angular momentum is conserved, and the so-called adiabatic invariant, which is the orbit integral of the velocity, is conserved. This defines adiabatic growth. You take an initial power law profile and you plug it in and you get out a different power law profile. So it's a one-line calculation to do analytically. Simulations show the same result modulo this numerical change in where it starts growing from. You can see that this is very steep growth. I mean, this gains in a very short distance in radii a factor of almost 10 to the 6th in density, which is enormous, it gets so steep that you get to the density where annihilations start to matter. So there is a certain density for which, given the length of time that a particle has stayed in the spike, collisions over that time will start to matter, and then annihilations will then limit the growth of the spike. And what happens at this radius where you hit this annihilation density is that the spike turns over. Instead of giving a flat limiting density, it actually still grows with a very shallow power law. And this shallow power law you can understand mostly as particles that are on fairly eccentric orbits that live most of their time further out, they actually come in and fill in a very shallow power law growth in the inner spike. And then eventually, if you go all the way to the very inner region, annihilations will start really depleting everything and eating away the core of the spike. This is a very tiny volume that it's not important to model. Okay.
Into account the fact that dark matter is annihilating?
Yep. Yeah. If dark matter did not annihilate, so for instance, if you were interested in an asymmetric dark matter spike, this would just keep growing until you started hitting the region near the very horizon where you have to worry about general relativistic effects, which we don't worry about here. Okay.
At what distance would they become relativistic?
So general relativistic corrections are mostly important way down here, so right near the horizon. So at 6m on C, actually, which is a bit bigger than the horizon.
Yeah. So does the question depend on whether this is S-wave or P-wave?
Yes, it certainly does, and that's actually part of where we're heading. Yeah. So this assumes S-wave. Okay. So the price of having a steep power law is that any uncertainty in the input parameters that you put into this thing also gets raised to a high power. So it's clear that this incredible gain in density and in an annihilating dark matter model, when your signals go like density squared, this is going to be an enormous magnification lens for any signal that you have. But the price for that is that it's a magnification lens for all of your uncertainties, and because this is astronomy, we have lots of uncertainties. So some of the most important input parameters are the following. So first of all is the mass of the black hole. And this is, for our purposes, this is not uncertain at all. if you compare the uncertainty of the measurement of the Milky Way's supermassive black hole mass, you can forget that uncertainty in comparison to everything else. So we just take it as a fixed number and forget the uncertainties. So for those of you who don't know, there are some beautiful videos by Andrea Ghez and her group at UCLA where they actually have taken enough measurements over enough time of the stars that are orbiting very, very close to the black hole. And you can just watch in real time the orbits being traced out. And you have enough stars and enough orbital measurements that you can get a very precise determination of the gravitational potential of this guy. So, 4 times, 10 to the 6 times as massive as the sun, that's the black hole mass. Then there's the velocity dispersion. This is, we're using measurements from the stellar population. This is much less precisely determined, and I'll show some 1 sigma bands later. But the real kick is the dark matter particle properties, because we still have no real measurement of these. We don't know what our dark matter halo looks like. We have some rough guesses. We don't actually know. And if you have a potential signal, then you could make some precise statements. So let me talk about applying this to the galactic center excess, not necessarily because I think it's dark matter and we're learning something concrete, but because it allows us to get some quantitative intuition for what this would do to a generic S-wave annihilation signal. So this is the galactic center excess. These plots are from the paper by Tracy, Dan, and collaborators. There, of course, have been some interesting subsequent updates if you're interested in the very detailed particle story. But since we're trying to learn general lessons, I'm just going to keep using these plots. So this excess from the galactic center, they see, so these are from minus 20 to 20 degrees. These are from minus 5 to 5. So this these plots zoom in on this very central region. So you can see that this excess is approximately spherically symmetric, and it extends out to relatively high latitudes. And it is well fit by dark matter annihilations in an NFW halo with a central power law which is somewhat bigger than one. There are some good arguments for why the central power law should be somewhat steeper than one. One is what comes out of dark matter-only simulations with some range, depending on what galaxy you're talking about. When baryons dissipatively collapse into the disk, that can adiabatically contract the dark matter, and so you tend to get slightly steepened, over-contracted halos. Gamma C of anything bigger than one is, strictly speaking, over-contracted. Okay. So when they fit the full sky or the southern sky, so half of their data for a consistency check, this prefers an inner profile slope, so an inner power law, somewhere between 1.2 and 1.3. And this rate, you know, this is what the excess spectrum looks like. The emission is spatially uniform. It has an overall mass scale consistent with the dark matter mass in the tens of GeV range. This particular fit is the canonical B-quark annihilating at 35 GeV. And of course, the rate is pretty consistent with S-wave thermal. So we'll take this as a candidate, you know, S-wave signal with some indication for, very critically, what halo we're living in, and some information about the dark matter particle properties, so cross-section, final state, mass. Okay? And now we can sort of get a better sense, concretely, of what does the spike signal look like compared to the halo signal. Okay? So again, we expect that this dependence will be somewhat sensitive. I'll plot the spike to halo ratio. This is testing the dependence of the spike profile itself on the dark matter particle properties, because I'm looking at two photon flux things and I'm taking the ratio, so all of the prefactors are canceling out, right? The cross section, the mass, that canonical prefactor is canceling out. The only thing that's surviving here in this ratio is the ratio of J factors, and the reason this depends on dark matter particle properties is for the dark matter spike, that J factor itself depends on dark matter particle properties. Because it hits that annihilation radius and turns over. So this is the dependence on the velocity dispersion. So our central value is 105 kilometers per second. We go up and down by one sigma, which is about 20 kilometers per second. And so you see that gives you a pretty big variation already. You go from the spike being 65 times brighter than the inner 1 degree of the halo to something where it's only 20 degrees brighter than the inner 1 degree of the halo. I pick 1 degree because that's a rough estimate of Fermi's angular resolution. So in other words, if you take Fermi, you point it at the inner 1 degree, you see, you know, all the halo, and then what you would see is a point source because the black hole's spike itself is extremely small. But because Fermi does not have great angular resolution, we're just approximating it as, say, 1 degree, which is a conservative estimate of the angular resolution. So that's why we're comparing this to the halo in the inner 1 degree. Okay. So this is the uncertainty that comes from our ignorance of the dark matter velocity dispersion. This is what happens if I take the dark matter particle properties. The only way the spike J factor depends on dark matter particle properties is through this parameter, you know, the annihilation density. And so if I vary that up and down by a factor of two, you see that I get a big spread in the uncertainty on spike to halo, the possible range of predictions. Note that what never changes is that the spike is much, much brighter than even the very central part of the halo signature. Okay. You might note also that this annihilation density, I'm selling it like it depends on dark matter particle properties, and it does, but it also depends on this weasel parameter tau, which is the amount of time that the particle spends in the spike. That's astrophysics. Okay, so This is the name of the game. You can get interesting new particle physics information out of these signals, but it's always bound up with some astrophysical story about the formation of the spike, the lifetime of the spike. This is a theme. So, okay, and what happens if I vary the halo from which on top of which the spike is growing? I get roughly the same amount of spread in possible spike to halo signals. Again, the spike is always significantly brighter, more than an order of magnitude brighter than the inner 1 degree of the halo. The big difference between spikes from gamma C of 1 to gamma C of 1.4 is not that the spike itself is changing, it's that the spike is growing on top of a bigger density to start with, and therefore hits the annihilation density sooner and gives you a bigger flux. So let's now ask, what do we actually see at the galactic center? And when we wrote this paper, which was about a year ago, we opened up what was then the most up-to-date information about the point sources in the center of the galaxy. This is Fermi's second point source catalog. And we saw that there was really only one possible candidate for a black hole spike. There was you look in the inner 1 degree around the galactic center, and there was one very bright point source that was very close within Fermi's angular resolution, close to Sagittarius A star, which is our black hole. So this is that source. It's unassociated in the catalog, meaning they don't assign it to any known source. And it has a spectrum which is kind of intriguingly close to the spectrum of the Fermi excess. So we got a little excited. And we said, okay, what does this look like when we compare it to, well, the inner 1 degree of the halo? So that's what, 35 GeV particle annihilating to BB bar looks like for the best fit halo parameters from Dalen et al. And that's what the adiabatic spike looks like. It is significantly in excess of the data. The kinds of things that it takes to bring down this spike is an interesting question. The first thing you would ask is, okay, can I bring it down with just particle properties? So you can take a whole bunch of different, particle physics models, fit the spectrum from the halo about exactly the same, turn around and say, what do I get for the spike? And the basic idea is you get about a factor of 1.5. You definitely do not get an order of magnitude. So this is the kind of information you're learning intrinsically about particle physics from the spike. It's hard to imagine, at least to me, that you would think that you understood the formation history of the spike enough to have a spike-only measurement and say, yes, really, this favors one particle physics model over the other. I don't feel like I understand, the lifetime of the spike and the extent to which I trust my adiabatic picture of the evolution of the spike over the entire evolution of the Milky Way galaxy to the level that would convince me that I live in this model and not this model. It really is a point source. So if you have lots of photons, of course, you can you get angular resolution much better. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the intrinsic angular resolution of Fermi is energy dependent. For high energy photons, it goes down to about a third of a degree. That's sort of the best-ish you can do. Right, but they don't have good coverage at low energy. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. So you want the best energy. Better angular resolution would help enormously prospects for future things that I'll touch on later would be much better with Cherenkov telescopes than with Fermi. Yeah. Okay. So what does it take to bring down these kinds of spike predictions to something that isn't massively ruled out by what we see at the galactic center? Well, if you are married to this idea of adiabatic growth for this black hole spike, then you have to do something like increase velocity dispersion by more than one sigma and bring down your central power law index and reduce your particle saturation density by a lot. This is really hard to do given this particular dark matter signal. If somebody came along later and said, I found another excess and it favors a much shallower halo profile, then maybe you'd be in business again. But given the kinds of S-wave signals people are talking about now, you cannot accommodate an adiabatic black hole spike.
So does this combination of requirements also tell you what your town needs to be in order to get around that?
Yeah, right. So I would have to do something like increase the age of the Milky Way by inappropriate amounts. So since we wrote this paper, Fermi came out with a third point source catalog, which took the one point source that we looked at when we did that paper and split it into two, one of which, the green one, is officially associated with Sagittarius A by Fermi. It's a little bit closer to the observed position of Sagittarius A star. And then this guy, which is a little bit brighter but a little bit further away. And so the case that one of these should contain the emission from a black hole spike becomes even harder to make. Okay. Neither one of these is very obviously a black hole spike associated with the galactic center excess spectrum. Okay. So there are many other possibilities for what might be going on with dark matter around our black hole. This adiabatic spike is one particular solution that made a lot of assumptions. Of course, the most obvious one is that our black hole formed adiabatically. If instead you had some sort of sudden origin when you started out with two much smaller black holes that merged, made a bigger black hole, that would be one way to get a very different kind of spike. This is somewhat unlikely to have happened in the Milky Way. Evidence suggests that our Milky Way has not undergone major mergers for a very long time. So, for instance, just recently, Gaia reported they don't see a thick disk of stars. That would be one of the signals of a recent major merger.
Why? Enough dwarfs in the binary that you could tear out on the region.
Yeah, so you have to have a merger that comes centrally enough and disrupts the very central bulge. Fairly recently, the stellar bulge. In order to affect what's going on gravitationally, right around the very central black hole, you have to have something that really perturbs that region. Okay. Yeah.
Be sufficient torques. I mean, there are models that.
Oh, well, sure. But if you're doing this all the way back at the very beginning of the galaxy, right? It'll have formed, and then it'll just grow adiabatically again. We're talking about something that would have happened more recently to give you a different spike story. And then that would leave some sort of traceable dynamical origin that you would be able to see by its imprint in stars.
I'm not sure.
And there... it is certainly true that if you have two things in spiraling that'll eject things from their immediate vicinity, but I don't think that's a plausible, I don't think that's something that people consider very strongly as a possible origin scenario for the Milky Way in particular. Now, at this point, I'm mostly trusting my astrophysical colleagues, so caveat on that. The adiabatic spike solution depends on having an input halo that it's growing from that is some sort of generalized NFW halo. If you have a different kind of halo, you get a different kind of spike. And in particular, if you grow from a constant halo, you get a much shallower spike with a spike of only 1.5 is the limiting spike index. So that's a much shallower spike, so a much weaker signal. If the black hole is not coincident with the center of the dark matter halo, you get, again, a very shallow spike. You get spikes that are only R of minus 1/2, which is too shallow to be interesting in terms of observable signals. If dark matter has strong self-interactions, so that processes, so that the dark matter is actually a collisional fluid instead of a collisionless fluid, that also changes the limiting form for the solution. But the mechanism I personally find most likely to be happening in the Milky Way in particular is what happens if you can't ignore the stars. So instead of just talking about the interactions of dark matter with a black hole, you have to worry about the gravitational interactions with the very dense, anomalously dense, it turns out, bulge of stars that are right inside the central region of the Milky Way. So the canonical adiabatic spike solution that I showed you made a bunch of assumptions. One of them was that you could ignore the baryons, and the other one was that the phase-based densities are conserved, so that in particular, you don't follow dark matter falling into the black hole. If you relax these two assumptions and you put in a sufficiently dense and sufficiently cuspy central distribution of stars, the fact that the stars are much heavier than the dark matter means that the net effect of sort of two-body slingshot interactions between a dark matter particle and stars tends to either whip dark matter into the black hole or out of the spike. And this is a net transfer of energy from the stars to the dark matter population, which means it drives the spike from an initial adiabatic distribution down to something which is flatter. So it's still a spike, but it's much flatter than the initial adiabatic spike. This process has a limiting steady state solution, again, of r to the minus 1.5, so by coincidence, the same power law that if you have a spike going from a chord halo. But the relaxation timescale depends on the density of stars. And we really don't have very good measurements of what that central density is in the Milky Way. So is this happening in the Milky Way? I have no idea. The one thing that we think is that we can say is that the relaxation timescale is likely somewhat longer than the age of the Milky Way. So it is very plausible then that you look at the center of the Milky Way and you have some dark matter spike that is in the process of relaxing but has not yet made it all the way to the equilibrium 1.5 solution. So as a particle person, I'm not quite sure how impossible it is to get these measurements. There's a lot of gas and dust between us and the stars we'd like to see in visible light. I don't know how likely it is to be able to clear this up in detail. What I do know is that this makes sense to talk about things in terms of a parameter space. This is how I parameterize my inner halo. This is how I parameterize my spike. Anything in this region is potentially something that we could care about. Okay? So that's the approach that I'll take. So given that I've got huge power laws that raise my big uncertainties to high power, given that I have no idea how to incorporate unknown baryons into this problem, why am I still thinking about black hole spikes? Usually when astronomical uncertainties get this big, particle physicists start looking for something a bit more certain to do. The reason I'm still doing this is because you really get something qualitatively new. Oh, sorry. let me back up a little bit, sorry. Just to show you, this is what happens when you have weaker spikes. So it really makes a big difference in terms of observability, whether you have an adiabatic spike or a much weaker spike. So this limiting stellar heated spike, when you let stellar heating drive everything down to the equilibrium value, is only just barely above the halo signal, which is, again, the dotted line. Yeah.
Forget about the stars. What is the time scale?
Yeah, 10 to the 12 years.
10 to the 12
age of the Milky Way.
For the spike.
10 to the 12.
Years?
Sorry.
That's
sorry,
not
sorry, 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 sorry.
That doesn't sound right.
Sorry, 10 to the 10. 10 to the 10. I beg your pardon, 10 to the 10.
So it takes basically the age of the universe for the spike to form.
Age of the Milky Way is what we're taking, yeah. Which is most of the age of the universe.
Why is that the relevant time scale and not the infall rate in the galaxy? Because there's a dynamical time scale in the galaxy itself, the fact that the time it takes for things to go around, which is a million years. This is the dynamical time scale for the galaxy. This is how fast things.
The relevant timescales here are not the timescales of the whole galaxy. They're the timescales of things very close
right,
to the black hole.
Right. So just the platform has not done anything for the last 10 billion years. Then, so this is for the this is for the spike to go like this for the adiabatic.
That's right.
And
yeah, there are a lot of assumptions in the canonical adiabatic spike. If you remember nothing else, remember that. And people write papers about black hole spikes, and they're only talking about the Gundalow silk spike, which is the canonical adiabatic spike. There are an enormous number of assumptions in that. And it's really important to know what those are. And one of them is exactly this, that you model adiabatic growth, and you don't have to know the beginning, you don't have to know the end. Oh, but you should turn it over at some time scale. That's a big assumption. You're very right to point that out.
And then you're saying the heating now will want to smooth it out.
That's right. That's right.
You don't know which one is faster, right? Because they're both happening at the same time. So you don't. So it's not like the spike would fall first
and then
relax.
Go down,
mm-hmm. right? I mean, if
yeah, the, mm-hmm. yeah. What you really would want to do ideally is,
right.
you know, be able to, you know. Take some distribution for the stars, some distribution for the dark matter, let it all evolve on very, very fine scales, track that down to, you know, the very tiny scales that pertain, and be able to really do that dynamically, and get out something that looks like the Milky Way at the end. That's a very hard thing to do astrophysically because you require something that has a very big dynamical scale range. And so those simulations aren't available. This is, again, yeah.
Is not enough. Basically, the blue line, the very blue line, and the green line set you basically the uncertainty.
That's exactly right, and that's why I still find it useful to consider both of these cases. These basically bracket the uncertainty, and you should. And what we should be learning from this is that you should think about possible signals as being a two-dimensional space of interest. You know, this is my inner halo. This is my spike, and just treat the spike index as something that is free. In terms of designing a search strategy. These are the extreme cases.
Earlier you mentioned that strong self-interaction is another way to solve this. So the interaction scale is to be done for some of the smallest models.
Yeah, if you have something that big that would change the formation of the spike, right? So basically if you have a collisional fluid, that gives you a different solution than if you have an adiabatic spike. Another way to say that is one of the inputs to the adiabatic spike solution is that gravity was the only thing in the game. In other words, if I turn on collisions, my phase space density is no longer conserved. So I have to compute the scattering process as well.
Would imply that you state it too much, so you have to asymmetric definition.
I'm not sure what you mean. This is.
I guess it's model difference.
Yeah, the statement about strong self interactions is just that, speaking purely about the. Turning off the annihilations has nothing to do with annihilations. It has to do with the long range. Forces and the phase space evolution in a gravitational potential of a point mass. Okay. Right, so given these huge uncertainties and the fact that it is intrinsically bound up in the formation of the Milky Way and its black hole, why, as a particle person, should you still be interested in thinking about black hole spikes? This is the answer for me. If I have a power law density profile inside the gravitational zone of influence of a point mass, then two lines of hydrodynamics, the pressure is rho times velocity dispersion, the force is due to the black hole, give you that the velocity dispersion has to increase as 1 on r, just to support that power law increase in density. So for the Milky Way spike that I was showing you, the same numbers give you this linear increase in the velocity dispersion. And this is V squared. This is thermal freeze-out value. Okay. And as you can see, if I have P wave annihilation, I similarly hit a region here. So these kinks are where I switch over from one power law to the inner power law. You can see I have a kink. I switch over from my main spike to my inner spike, annihilations inside the spike are important. P wave annihilations are important in the present day, which means we can maybe see them. So a P wave spike in purple, in blue compared to the S wave spike in purple, P wave spike, you know, the annihilations are smaller as a rate because they depend on velocity, which is small still. So it takes longer to reach the annihilation density, but because you keep growing the density, you eventually hit the combination of density and increased velocity where annihilations are important. It turns over and it gives you the same limiting inner power law. This inner r to the 1/2 doesn't depend on whether you have velocity constant or velocity changing. So here is a very simple model of P-wave dark matter. This is a hidden freeze-out model. It's fermionic dark matter that annihilates to pairs of scalars that couple to the standard model by mixing with the Higgs. This has cosmologically prompt decay as long as S is not too light. This model has three free parameters, which you can take to be the mass of the dark matter, the mass of the scalar field, and the Yukawa coupling between the dark matter and the dark mediator. And then in addition, it has the lifetime of the scalar, but that's basically irrelevant for the astrophysical degrees of freedom as long as it's small compared to the hidden sector couplings. So this has a cross-section that is very generically expressed in terms of, you know, the Yukawa coupling, mass of the dark matter, phase space, and then some function of the mass ratio. And it starts at P wave because I've got a P odd initial state annihilating to a P even final state. So the first contribution to the cross section has to be in the P wave. So this model is extremely simple and it is extremely difficult to see. So it's a hidden sector freeze out model, which means all of my terrestrial signals are parametrically suppressed. So direct detection, thermal freeze out tells me what value of the Yukawa coupling I need, so I'll fix that value and then ask how can I see these couplings terrestrially. Direct detection gives me a constraint on the mixing angle between the scalar and the Higgs boson that is a function of dark matter mass and the mass ratio between dark matter and the mediator is order 10 to the minus 3. Up to 10 to the minus 2, okay? And direct production at colliders is similarly very suppressed. If Higgs can decay into these, that's the best that colliders can do, but this is a very hard signal because it's Higgs to something all hadronic in the bulk of parameter space. So if I ask that I have a 10% branching ratio, which I could exclude roughly at the LHC, that gives me something that is 5 times 10 to the minus 3. Next generation LUX will beat that. Okay. But you can see it not in the halo, because there is no halo signature for a P wave dark matter model. The halo signature is 10 to the minus 5 times what it would be for an S wave signal. That's, for practical purposes, unobservable. But you can see it in the black hole. So what you would be seeing is a point source in gamma rays localized near Sagittarius A star, where all of the emission is due to dark matter annihilation. And this is the kind of way you could go about right now to getting limits on what the continuum looks like. So I take some continuum emission for some choice of mass parameters and ask, you know, compare this to the spectrum of the point sources that Fermi actually sees. And using this as a guide to what is observable, I can ask at what value of the cross section does this black hole-induced dark matter signal become brighter than the point sources that Fermi sees in any given bin. This is another point for which you can see how the spectrum changes relative to the spectrum that's being seen. These are adiabatic spikes in the same overcontracted spectrum. This is a nice place to live in terms of spike signals. These limits are 10 to the minus 2 times thermal, 5 times 10 to the minus 2 times thermal. But of course, you've seen me talk about how many uncertainties there are. If I just, you know, give you a spectrum, I give you a two-parameter model that can dial the continuum signal to fit that spectrum, and I say, you don't know that this is a pulsar. It could be dark matter. I fit it with a spectrum, and you know, it fits with this particular astrophysical model. You would not believe me. And you would want some sort of sharp kinematic feature to be certain that this actually was dark matter and not, you know, me inventing a history to explain a pulsar wind nebula in terms of dark matter. So for these hidden sector freeze-out models, instead of lines, you get boxes, because it is not your dark matter annihilating directly to photons, it is your mediator decaying to photons, and your mediator is boosted. And so that spreads out what would be a line into a box, where the limits of the box depend on your mass ratio. There is one Fermi line search which does not mask point sources. The vast majority of them do. This line search focuses on the inner a circle of radius 3 degrees around the galactic center. And this is their limit compared to the flux that you'd expect for adiabatic spikes in slightly contracted NFW halos. And you can see that this is interesting for the adiabatic case. For Higgs portal dark matter models, this Higgs-like branching ratio to di photons is order 10 to the minus 3 or worse. So you really take a big hit if your mediator, you know, decays like Higgs's or like, you know, radiatively. Okay? So to summarize, in terms of this sort of general parameter space, so here's the halo, here's the spike index. This line is the adiabatic spike. This floor here is what I'm saying the limiting heated spike is. This is where line searches rule out the thermal cross-section for the Higgs portal dark matter model. If I optimize those searches, because those are looking for lines from a halo, they're not looking for lines in a point source, they're looking for lines in a much bigger region than you have to. If I make a naive estimate and just assume that it scales like S on root background and background is flat, and just shrink it down to a 0.3 degree radius circle, that improves my limit by quite a lot. So take this as a rough estimate for the line search sensitivity. This is where I get point sources that are brighter than what Fermi sees, depending on which of the three interesting point sources I might be comparing it to. Okay. If you do a little better by saying, let me suppose that I have a dark matter model that decays order one at a time to photons, then you are sensitive to this kind of model for a much wider range of possible histories for the center of our galaxy. So the take-home message is Fermi should be looking for lines and boxes in the spectra of bright point sources, both in our galaxy and in other galaxies. So the takeaway is that supermassive black holes are dark matter observatories. If there's a spike, this does two things for you. It concentrates an enormous density of dark matter, and it also increases the velocity of dispersion to support that density. That combination of things can give you qualitatively interesting, novel cosmic ray signatures that might teach you enough unique information that it makes sense for particle physicists to put up with the astrophysical uncertainties. The spike emission probes a different combination of particle parameters and galactic dynamics. You get new information at the cost of having to non-trivially engage with the astrophysical uncertainties. As a side note, you know, pick at most one dark matter interpretation of the galactic center excess or an adiabatic spike. There are other applications of these mild dark matter accelerators. In particular, looking for new signals of co-annihilation that turn on specifically in dark matter-induced density spikes, that's work in progress. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? So, have you thought at all about the chaos rate of asymmetric dark matter and the small subdominant symmetric component? I guess you could also get higher densities.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So what you would typically expect is you would, as you say, you just keep extrapolating down to hit a much higher plateau. So you would get smaller signals because your overall signal scales like through the radius of where that happens. But depending how aggressive you're willing to be and how much of a spike you're willing to assume, you could still get some interesting signals. It would be an interesting way to test that. But I don't actually have any numbers. There are some galaxies, by the way, where you might expect adiabatic spikes to be more likely, such as, in particular, M87, which is a monster black hole, and it has a much less dense sort of stellar nucleus. Something that apparently is unusual about the Milky Way is that its stellar bulge is very dense. And so that means stellar heating is much more likely to be important here than it is in other galaxies. M87, you have a different issue, which is you have jet emission, which means you have background if you wanted to do a gamma ray search. But it has, and the other thing is that it's much further away, so you have to wait much longer to integrate good statistics. But the fact that you do have a very big black hole and a much stronger case that it could be an adiabatically growing black hole makes it particularly interesting. Unfortunately, we were beaten to the punch a bit by a paper that appeared last week. Yeah, but I think the other thing that you would want if you wanted to make a systematic study of potential black hole induced signals of dark matter is to establish multiple targets, because you know, each target has so many astrophysical uncertainties, you want to be able to compare lots of them and try to better be able to filter the particle stuff from the astrophysical stuff. Yeah.
You can try to link to some other anomalies. For example, you can mimic 511 KAD line with a tiny annihilation cross section. Because what happens is that if you have a point source annihilation in 2E+ or -, it takes a million years for positrons to produce 511 lines, so they will randomize in the center, right, and occupy some volume. But you can
escape
other constraints because you can tune down the cross section.
Yeah. I had trouble convincing myself that they could actually, given a point source origin, diffuse out to big enough regions to match the signal. But well, generically, you do expect strong magnetic fields. But I mean, when I say I had trouble convincing myself, I mean, I went and I looked up some of the numbers that people throw around, and I said, oh, this doesn't work. But that's very different from taking a critical look at how people estimate the magnetic fields. What could you get away with?
Then you can constrain the models that they find, right? Because then you'll have a bright source of 511 if they die where they produce.
Is this not very important for dark galaxy? Yeah, there aren't big black holes in dwarfs. Yeah, so stellar heating wouldn't be an issue. The issue is just that you don't expect to have big black holes. You have much fewer baryon per dark matter halo, and the dark matter, black holes mostly grow from eating baryon.
Just like other galaxies have a, when you sum them all together, produce a diffuse extragalactic signal. There's presumably also a diffuse extragalactic signal of all the.
I mentioned.
Is that comparable to what's expected from.
It's smaller, so it's always smaller when it's P wave. Let me separate your question into S wave and P wave. So if it's S wave, then you have all your halo signal. And on top of that, you have this crazy bright contribution from black holes at various stages of evolution.
Right.
If it's P wave, you have no halo signal, and your spike signal is much bigger than you would naively think, but it is still smaller than just an S wave pure halo. Yeah. The thing that, I'm still building up tolerance to the uncertainties involved in astrophysical modeling, and I have not quite hit the stage where I'm willing to put in, you know, power law predictions for, But, you know, when I mentioned this to Steve Ritz, he was like, oh, yeah, the way to do this is just to take some sort of, you know, distribution for, you know, black holes in galaxies and do a statistical search in diffuse stuff. I'm like, (laughs) Yeah.
Any other questions? Great, let's think this.